From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Sam of the soul music duo Sam and Dave. In the 60s, Sam and Dave had the hit Soul Man, Hold On I'm Coming, and When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. Sam and Dave were part of the inspiration behind John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's Blues Brothers. Dave died in 1988. Sam Moore has a new CD featuring collaborations with singers including Bruce Springsteen, Sting, and Fantasia. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan continues her list of the year's best books, this time mysteries and nonfiction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sam Moore, is best known as the Sam in Sam and Dave, the soul music duo of the 60s that had the hits Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, When Something Is Wrong With My Baby, and I Thank You. Sam and Dave were also famous as one of the acts that inspired the John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd duo, the Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers' signature song was the Sam and Dave hit Soul Man. Sam Moore and Dave Prater broke up in 1970, although they reunited several times. Dave died in a car accident in 1988. Sam Moore has been performing solo, but he has a new album of collaborations with such singers as Bruce Springsteen, Sting, and Fantasia. One track has received a Grammy nomination. The album was produced by Randy Jackson, who's famous as one of the judges on American Idol. Moore really sounds great. Let's hear a track before we meet him. This is his duet with Wynonna, I Can't Stand the Rain.
I can't stand the rain against my window. Bring back sweet memories. Against my window, because she's not here with me.
When we were together, everything was so good.
Everything was so grand.
Now that we're parted, there's just one sound.
That's Sam Moore from his new CD, Overnight Sensational. Sam Moore, what a pleasure to have you here on Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. I have to say, you are still in great voice. Have you been singing straight through the years that you weren't recording?
Yes. Well, you know, you have to make a living, Terry. You know, and whether you have a record or you're recording or you... or whatever, you still have to pay those bills at home. I had been working in different capacities, from the oldies market to the ships and all these good things. So the answer to the question, I had been singing.
Now, you started to sing in church. Would you describe the church that you first sang in?
The church I first sang in. The church I first sang in, I think the first solo I may have had, I was about 9. I remember the first time I was given a solo to sing with the adult choir. I forgot the words.
Oh, no.
I did. It was a most embarrassing situation, because here's this little guy standing up before the big choir, and I have this solo to sing, and they're going to be singing behind me, and I forgot the words to the song. That was the most interesting part of my church. And before that, when I was a little boy, my parents were so happy to start grooming me to be this minister, you know, of gospel. And that was fine until I started taking up a collection from the people in the streets. And my mother caught me one day, and she was standing in the doorway in Miami, Florida, and she was standing. She had coming from school, and she came in through the back, and I was repeating my Lord's Prayer over and over and over and over and over and again, and I was also singing as the choir. Then I would say the Lord's Prayer over and over and over and over again. So I had a cup that I'd gotten out of the house, and I put it down on the side, and I was asking for a collection after the service, and she said, "I don't think that's funny. I think you better stop." And that's the beginning and the ending of my church experience.
So you sang gospel, and then you met Dave Prater, who was the Dave in Sam and Dave. How did you and Dave Prater meet?
It was a fluke. I was working at this club in Miami called the King of Hearts, and I had heard about this young man that was doing the amateur hours in Miami. And eventually he got out to where I was singing, MC, comedian, whatever you want to call it. I wasn't good at any of it, but it was a good job. It was a job to do. And he came out there, and I got his name, and I said, "Oh, you're the young man that's doing Sam Cooke's songs and whatnot." And he said, "Yeah, but I don't want to do that this time. I'm going to do a Jackie Wilson's." And I said, "What song would that be?" And he said, "Dogging Me Around." I said, okay. And he did, he was okay until he got to the verses. And when he got to the verses, he had a meltdown. I'm being a professional and knowing this young fellow by the name of Jackie Leroy Wilson, I knew him well enough. I knew all his songs. I knew everything that he was doing. So I said, "Look, I'll try and help you out," which I shouldn't have been doing. But like I said, it was a fluke because I stayed up there, and there were some mistakes and some things done. Dave being nervous and my being a klutz. it caused Sam and Dave behind the nervousness and the klutzness to be together for almost 21 years.
Now, it was the way that you kind of bailed him out of the verses that he didn't know. Was that how you developed your way of duetting and alternating with each other?
No. No, that came later on in the studios when we started recording. Because they never could, at the time we started recording at in Memphis at the studio Stax, they were trying to get us to harmonize, and that wasn't working. So we started doing a call and response sort of thing. I think the closest we ever came to harmonizing with any song for the time we recorded there was like "Something Is Wrong with My Baby," or mm-hmm. "You Don't Know Like I Know," or "I Take What I Want." But that was the closest of harmonizing that Dave and I came. But most of our songs, if you hear the older things that we did, was call and response.
Well, when you started singing together, you were signed first to Roulette Records, but then you were signed by Jerry Wexler to Atlantic Records, and that's when things really took off. He wanted you to record at the in Memphis at the Stax Records studio, and Atlantic had some kind of tie-in with Stax. Why did he want to take you down to Memphis?
I don't think they were looking for these two guys to be, you know, that big or whatever. I don't know. I figured they could make money with us or whatever. But when we got down there, I was so disappointed because I didn't like any of the songs that they introduced to us. I didn't, because I was into that Clyde McFadder, the Drifters, and Big Joe Turner, Ray Charles. I was into that mold. And I wanted to, you know, do, songs like Jackie and Clyde and all this stuff. But it didn't work out that way. And when they started giving us the songs and with the titles of Jody Ryder and Jody Get Your Gun and all this stuff, I said, "Oh, my God, our career's dead." I'll show you how much I knew.
My guest is Sam Moore. His new CD is called Overnight Sensational. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sam Moore, best known as half of the 60s soul music duo Sam and Dave. Moore has a new CD called Overnight Sensational. Isaac Hayes and David Porter wrote most of your hits, like Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, When Something Is Wrong with My Baby, I Thank You. When you first met Isaac Hayes, did he give you a sense of the sound that he heard you doing?
No. When I first met Isaac, coming down the street, I thought he was the most strangest looking person I had ever seen. You must understand, at that time, Isaac had hair on his head.
That's hard to imagine.
Yeah, I know. He had hair, Terry. He had on a pink shirt and green, I think they were green pants. I'm colorblind, so I could be wrong. It could have been another color. But I think he had on green pants with a white belt and pink socks with white shoes. And I went, oh, my God, what is this coming down the street dressed like that? And I basically started crying. Because I went, oh, my God, what is, you know, what's happening here? Why would they do this to me? But again, show you how much I knew. Soon after I met David, and he was an insurance runner at the time in Memphis and working at a store on the corner of Stacks. He was dressed with pants, looked like pal pushers. You know, and a little short hat and this sweater. What are you doing with a sweater on that time of hot summer day? I mean, it was hot, and the pants were real high, and he had on these funny-looking socks with rivets in it. And I said, oh, boy. And that's how I met those two.
And did you feel different when they started giving you songs?
I did. I felt like I wanted to go home. Please send me back home.
Even after they gave you the songs?
Well, when they started playing them and saying, these are songs we've come up, you know, we were writing for you and Dave, and I'm standing there and can't you find another way of doing it? It's sort of like a take off on a country song. And I actually, if you go back and play it, I actually interpreted it that way. I sang it that way. You know, I was so dissatisfied with this. I didn't try to do anything with it. I just sang it like they were, you know, they were playing it for me and recorded it like that.
Okay, so when they gave you Hold On, I'm Coming, which was a huge hit for you, your first really big hit, did you like that?
No.
But it's such a great record. What did you do to make it more to your liking?
Nothing. I think it was more... I didn't do anything, Terry. Up to that point, I was just singing the song as straight as I could because I wasn't familiar with that kind of with what they were trying to do, and I was trying to feel my way through.
Well, let's hear it. This is Sam and Dave, their first really big hit, "Hold On, I'm Coming." That's Sam and Dave, recorded in 1966. And my guest is the Sam of Sam and Dave, Sam Moore. And he has a new CD, which is called Overnight Sensational. Now, you were saying you didn't like the song when Isaac Hayes and David Porter, the writers of the song, gave it to you. But did you imagine the song not only like with your voices in it, but also like with the Memphis horns behind you?
You know, to move on with the Sam and Dave thing, I was comfortable after, believe this or not, after Dave and I split up the first time. And I had a problem because it's not that I felt as though I was better than Dave or better than what was being given to me. I knew that I could sing other songs other than Hold On, I'm Coming, Soul Man, Hold On, you know. And I wanted to stretch my wings, and with what was happening in our career, in our personal lives, I actually took advantage of that, and I walked away in 1969, the first time I walked away. But it was not that I wanted to break up the act. I just wanted to do other material because I felt myself being pigeonholed into something that was going to come back and bite me, which it did.
Mm-hmm. Had to come back and bite me. You mean like you couldn't get out of that? You always had to do those hits.
Absolutely. And you know what? I tell you the truth, Terry. It's still happening today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it still happens today. I mean, all over the country, people are still saying, "Well, I like that. I like what you're doing, Sam. I like your voice singing, sort of. But why you don't have another guy? Why you don't have another guy? Just go get a guy and call him Dave." And I'm going, "What?" You know, and it worried me. So it was actually Sam and Dave became an albatross around my neck for a long, even as you and I are speaking now, you know. So it would bother me for a long time.
Well, because Sam and Dave is such an important part of soul music history, I want to ask you a few more questions about that. Is that all right?
Sure.
Great.
Sure.
Now, I've got to play Soul Man because it's such a well-known recording of yours. What did you think of this song when you were given it? And was it a song you wanted to do?
Yes, and well, no. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
No, I didn't want to do Soul Man, you know, because I felt it was putting us in a. You must understand it was the pinnacle part of coming out of segregation, and it was a message there. But I didn't feel it that way. I felt like it was more bluesy kind of thing. I had no idea the song was going to get as big as it did. I had no idea.
Did it seem like a novelty song to you?
Well, no, it was not like that. It was, I know it was something about it. I think it was... To me, it was just too many. I'm a soul man. I got sick of that. And I tell you, over the years, I've turned the song around, over, flipped it around. I've done it all kind of ways not to become so boring because I know I have to do it. You know,
right.
People love the song, so if they love it, you have to shut your mouth and just get on up there and do it. You know. Stop complaining, but no, I didn't like it when I first got the song.
You can put your hands over your ears because we're going to play it now.
Okay.
Terry. This is Sam and Dave, one of their really big hits, Soul Man.
Don't
That's Sam and Dave, recorded in 1967, Soul Man, another song that was written for them by Isaac Hayes and David Porter. Well, it's a great record, no matter what you say.
Yes. I mean, listen, everybody overrules me because they'll look at me when I say no. They say, well, you know what? You don't like it, but we're gonna still play it, and we'd like to hear you sing it. So you know what I do, Terry? I sing it. But
right.
But I've been able to now of late to do it and put in my it's done much differently at the end than I basically would have done it in the past. So it takes away all the all the stuff. I used the audience as my choir, and we go to have church with it now.
Sam Moore will be back in the second half of the show. His new CD is called Overnight Sensational. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I want everybody to get up off your seat and get your arms together and your hands together and give me some of that old soul clapping.
Coming up, the period when Sam and Dave didn't talk to each other off stage. We continue our conversation with Sam Moore, and book critic Maureen Corrigan chooses the best nonfiction books and mysteries of the year.
And I thank you. If you took your love somewhere else, I wouldn't know what it meant to be loved to death. You make me feel like I've never felt. Kisses so good, I have to holler for help. You didn't have to speak.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sam Moore. He's best known as half of the 60s soul music duo Sam and Dave, who had the hit Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, I Thank You, and When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. Sam and Dave were also an inspiration behind John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's Blues Brothers. Their signature song was Sam and Dave's Soul Man. When I mentioned to Moore that Aykroyd had once been a guest on our show, Moore spoke of him with great affection. Now, when John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd created the Blues Brothers and they started singing Soul Man, how did you first find out about it?
The first time I saw Danny and John do the song, I was watching Saturday Night Live, and they were doing it on their show. I'm not sure whether they were calling themselves the Blues Brothers then or not. I'm not sure. But I saw them do it, and I said, oh, that's hip, you know. It's a parody. It's okay. You know, it's fine. But then when they recorded it, that was fine also. I took issue in their doing the song after we played a couple of dates in New York City, I remember so well. And the kids walked up and they would say, you know that song, Soul Man? Yes. That you guys just finished doing? Yes. You know, the song that the Blues Brothers did, you know, you, I know you covered it. I'm telling you, Terry, they did.
That's sad. That's really sad.
And now what you're doing, you're trying to explain to them, no, they covered Sam and Dave's Soul Man. And they said, yeah, right. But anyway, we like it, like the way you guys, you all do it better than them. And I went, oh, man. No one at that time would believe that we were the original artist on the song.
It sounds like you had a pretty volatile relationship with Dave when you were performing. And it sounds like maybe he was a kind of volatile guy. I mean, he shot his wife. How did you know that? About him shooting his wife? I read about it.
You did, huh? Well, that was part of it, but you know, we also had a drug problem.
Both of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And after a while, it started telling on what, you know, the act was not dynamic. The act, sometimes they would show up, I didn't. Sometimes I would show up, he didn't. And it started telling on us on stage to the point that there's some footage that we were trying to upstage one another. We were being insulting to one another. And that spilled over into the audience. So it put it was not after the other part of 12 years that we were together. It didn't look very good at all. It was very, very, very bad.
Do you think drugs had to do with him shooting his wife?
No, not that. Dave was just one of those, you know, he was, I don't know what to call it. I don't know. Because I wasn't there. And when he did it, we had a concert to do in Atlanta, Georgia. I remember so well. And when he showed up, I remember saying to him, trying to talk to him, and he didn't want to hear what I had to say. And this is what caused the relationship to really get, you know, quieter, that's the only word I can find to say, because the relationship was not wherein he and I socialized. Mm-hmm. We never socialized together. Only time we did, unfortunate, was when we were doing dope, you know. Other than that, we didn't see each other. He had his friends, I had mine, or whatever you want to call it. But I don't know. I remember saying to him at the end, I'll sing with you if I must. I'll even record with you if I must, but I'll never talk to you again. So for the next 12 years, Harry, I had nothing to say to Dave Prater Jr. He had his dressing room, I had mine, and when we entered the stage, most of the times, I didn't listen to him. Now, you wouldn't believe that, but for the next 12 years, I didn't hear Dave. Whatever Dave was doing on stage, I tuned it out. That's how bad it was.
My guest is Sam Moore. His new CD is called Overnight Sensational. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sam Moore, best known as half of the 60s soul music duo Sam and Dave. Moore has a new CD called Overnight Sensational. Well, Sam and Dave broke up in 1970, although you did get back together again a couple mm-hmm. of times. But after, I guess it was after you broke up in 1970, you recorded a solo album for Atlantic Records.
Mm-hmm.
That was never released until, I think it was 2002, it was actually released. And there's some incredible stuff on that, as we'll hear in a moment. But what was the story behind this album, and what was it like for you? You know, you were telling us about your frustrations recording material with, you know, as half of Sam and Dave, that you didn't that you didn't really like that much, and that you didn't think showed off your your range as a singer. So what was it like for you to record this solo album?
I guess it was okay. You got to understand, Terry, I'm glad you asked that, because there are people that would have asked me about that. You know, I was getting high at that time. Mm. I was still influenced with the drug scene and whatnot. And when I was re-signed back as a solo performer with Atlantic, I was getting high, and they put the producer turned out to be King Curtis,
the saxophonist, who's also featured on that album.
Yes, and also was a musical director for Aretha Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also for the Coasters and whatnot. Very good producer. And I think, I tell you, Terry, if he had been alive today, I'm not so sure we would have been still together, but if working with him, he was, if you listen to the different songs that I was doing and performing, recording-wise, he was looking for a place for Sam Moore. And not a Sam and Dave, revisit it on anything like that. He was looking for a place to put Sam Moore, to give him a place in the industry as far as recording, to get me out of that Sam and Dave mode.
Well, we'll talk about this more, but let's stop here and hear some music. And this is a track from that album. The album's called Plenty Good Lovin', and it was released about 4 years ago. It's still available. Mm-hmm. So it was recorded in 1970, released about 4 years ago. And this track is called Part-Time Love. And you mentioned that King Curtis was, among other things, Aretha Franklin's music director. Aretha's featured on piano on this, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I said something to her the other night in Washington, D.C. at the honors of in Washington. And she was there honoring also to honor and introduce Smokey Robinson. And I walked over and I said, her assistants, I said to him, I said, he said, do you hear Part-Time Love? He said, sound like I hear Aretha. I said, it is Aretha. So he went over and he said something. So when I went over to her and I said something, she said, that's me? She said, is that me or is that Billy Preston? I said, no, that's you. She said, oh, okay. And then when when they played it after the other, you know, in the hotel or whatever, she came back. She said, you know, I was pretty good then, wasn't I? I said, yeah, you were good. You're still good, Aretha. So, yeah, that's Aretha on there.
Yeah, she was okay.
Yeah. She was all, as they say in the hip-hop world, she was odd.
Okay, so this is Sam Moore from his 1970 recording. The album's called Plenty Good Lovin', and this track is Part-Time Love with Aretha Franklin on piano.
It was early in the morning, and things are not right. You see, I had a little fight with my baby last night. And that's why I got to leave her. And the reason why is I got to find me. Oh, Lord. Lord, I got to find me a part-time love. I got to find don't mean to be so mean. Oh, baby.
Now, you know, before we heard that track, you said that had King Curtis lived, do you think maybe you would have continued to work together and you really liked working with him? But
yeah.
he didn't live. He was actually murdered. Would you tell us about the last time you saw him?
That was the last time when he was... I was going up to his apartment, his townhouse, and I remember going to see him because there was one more song that had to be done to finish the album up. And as I was coming up the street, Aretha was across the street, and she was also having a visit with him because she was getting ready to go in the studio also to record. And as I was walking up the street, they saw me, and they saw this young man and King Curtis get into it. And that was, as you all know, that was an altercation where King got stabbed, you know. And I saw her jump out the car, and she was screaming, somebody get the police, and I stopped. Now, why did I stop? I'm glad you asked. I had paraphernalia on me.
You were afraid you'd get busted.
Yeah, I could have gotten busted. So I backed up and I turned around and I went back and caught the train and went back to my house in, down on 54th Street. And by the time I got there, my girlfriend asked me, did I hear about it? And I said yes, but that was the last time I saw and heard from King.
Do you know what that fight was about?
No, I have no idea. There have been different stories told and that I've heard, and you know, there's a lot of hearsay about, well, this happened or that happened, but I personally have no idea what it was all about.
Now, you were telling us earlier that you sang in the church when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you had a pretty rough and maybe street-oriented life as a teenager. You were shot twice in your teenage years?
Yeah. You know, my mother and my grandmother did. They were wonderful, wonderful, caring, loving. They loved their son. And their grandson. But, you know, when you're a little guy, you got little man syndrome, you know, you want to be seen, you want to be heard, you want to be accepted. So, and you're watching things and watching people, and you want to emulate the people that you're trying to emulate is not the way to go in life. So, yeah, I started out real young, being a little, as they said, a little thug. And I got in a lot of trouble in those times. And that made the relationship between my mother and I sort of strain. My grandmother, I could do no wrong, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I played two against the other. You know those conditions, you know. When you play one, if mom said no, you go to grandma, and grandma say, okay. You know, she slipped me something, give me something, knowing, you know, I've done wrong.
Did music save you from that kind of life? I mean, once you actually started performing professionally, were you still in that kind of, were you still trying to be a thug, and were you still in a thuggish world?
Yeah. Yeah, I was still doing that. I mean, come on, I was still doing thuggish things and still going working at night in the nightclubs and, you know, and hanging with the thuggish and the things of that nature. Oh, God, yeah, I was a little gangster. Are you sorry you asked me now?
No. So how did, was it just like age that got you out of that?
No, what it was, I never got out of it. You know, I didn't get out of it. But if I did, I would have never got into drugs.
Right. Oh, I see your point.
Right.
I see your point. I see your point.
I never did get out of it. I was always into something, you know. I was always doing something. I was always running from one place to another. I was always ducking and hiding. And I enjoyed it because it was not a game. It was the way of life, as far as I could see it, you know.
Things pretty calm now in your life?
Oh, yeah. Well, heck, what am I going to do with these bad knees? No, I'm pretty quiet now as I've gotten older.
And you gave up drugs in, what, 82, was it? Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was 81. Yeah, about 82, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you're still singing and that your voice still sounds so good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been special to have you. Thank you.
Why, thank you so much, and don't be a stranger.
Sam Moore's new CD is called Overnight Sensational. Here's his duet with Bruce Springsteen, Better to Have and Not Need.
Oh, somebody, the sermon today is about a song I love so much. You know I can't get no more
satisfaction.
Girl, you just don't give me no more
inspiration.
Listen to me. You gone and lost that.
Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan chooses the year's best mysteries and nonfiction books. This is Fresh Air. Last week, our book critic Maureen Corrigan talked about her selections for the year's best novels and short story collections. She's back with her list of the year's best mysteries and nonfiction books.
Recently, I talked about the best fiction of 2006. There was such an abundance of marvelous literary novels and short story collections that I wasn't able to squeeze in a mention of genre fiction, specifically mystery and suspense. So, since this is my list and I get to do what I want, I'm beginning my rundown of best nonfiction books of 2006 with a quick but deferential nod to two terrific mysteries. Morag Joss's Puccini's Ghosts is a world-class creeper in the Ruth Rendell psychological suspense tradition. Set in a damp village in Scotland in the early 1960s, its main character is a young girl disastrously besotted by art and the wrong man. Far removed in location and style, George Pelicanos's latest edgy outing, The Night Gardener, continues to extend the possibilities of the form, using the crime novel to ruminate on the politics of race and class in urban America. The Night Gardener was inspired by a true-life cold case, a decades-old series of murders of young African-American women in Washington, D.C., that remains unsolved. The spellbinding memoir, Girls of Tender Age, by Marianne Tyrone Smith, also memorializes the murder of a young girl. Growing up in working-class Connecticut, Tyrone Smith attended Catholic grammar school with a classmate named Irene, who was snatched from a neighborhood street one evening in 1953 and murdered by a convicted sex offender. The next day at school, Tyrone Smith recalls her teacher announced to the class, "There will be no speaking of Irene." Then the maintenance man came in and carried Irene's desk out of the classroom, and all the kids moved up a space. Tyrone Smith, without a trace of opportunism, uses her memoir to break that silence. She memorializes her classmate and resurrects with anger, but also with nostalgia, her particular corner of 1950s America. Another book that makes the point that the good old days also have a lot to answer for is Impounded, a collection of photographs taken by Dorothea Lange of Japanese Americans interned during World War II. Lange was commissioned by the government to record the internment of some 110,000 Japanese Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor. She took over 700 photographs, stark and moving images of soon-to-be-interned kids dutifully saluting the flag, the abandoned horse stalls in California where families had to set up house for the duration, an interned mother and her son standing together in a field, him straight and stiff in a U.S. Army uniform. The historian editors of Impounded are Gary Y. Okahiro and Linda Gordon, whose prize-winning book, The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, appeared on my best books list of 1999. In its own very different fashion, Daniel Mendelsohn's magnificent book, The Lost, also investigates the long legacy of World War II. The Lost is Mendelsohn's frantic, utterly engrossing attempt to find out the truth of what happened to, as he says, 6 of the 6 million. That is, to 6 of his relatives who died in the Holocaust. Mendelsohn is a renowned literary critic, and here he mingles readings of the Bible and the classics with autobiography and a detective narrative, all in the effort to try to get to the heart of his relatives' vanished stories. Another big, idiosyncratic, and altogether fascinating work of nonfiction that came out this year was Ron Rosenbaum's book, The Shakespeare Wars. In it, Rosenbaum dives into the thick of controversies that continue to bedevil the bard and his works. Throughout his many world-spanning travels and conversations, Rosenbaum makes a stirring case that not only the arguments about, say, original spelling and folio dating of the plays matter, but that Shakespeare himself vitally matters. Finally, two biographies about men who themselves once mattered in America, but who've since been largely forgotten, make my nonfiction best list this year. Historian Debbie Applegate calls her account of the life of the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher the most famous man in America. In the course of this biography, she convinces readers of the truth of that swaggering title. What exactly made Beecher the signal man of the Victorian age in America? As Applegate describes, Beecher ushered in a new era of reckless optimism by replacing the wrathful god worshipped by the Puritans with a sunshiny god of love who showered upon Americans the blessings of leisure and self-fulfillment. Well, perhaps too much self-fulfillment. In 1874, Beecher was publicly accused of criminal conversation with his best friend's wife. A sensational trial ensued, and Beecher's star dimmed. Another great man who publicly walked hand in hand with his God was William Jennings Bryan, the subject of historian Michael Kazin's biography, A Godly Hero. As Kazin details, Bryan is a politically ambivalent figure, a champion of labor unions and government regulation of big business, as well as the ill-starred prosecutor in the Scopes trial, famously ridiculed by H.L. Mencken as a poor clod deluded by a childish theology. Maybe ambivalence rather than adoration is an inspired stance for a biographer to take, because Kazin's biography is extraordinarily rich and revealing. Both Beecher and Bryan were optimistic men, and in the course of reading about them, some of their positive thinking has rubbed off on me. In 2007, I'm looking forward to more enlightening memoirs, biographies, and works of cultural criticism. And as always, some great dark mysteries to cast a cloud over the sun.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. A complete list of her best books of 2006, fiction and nonfiction, will be on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Lizard's Bite, a mystery set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Sacred Cut. From American Jewish World Service, creating global health solutions community by community, on the web at ajws.org. And from Wyndham Hill, presenting George Winston's new solo piano album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a hurricane relief benefit, available at Borders. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Powers, this year's recipient of the National Book Award for Fiction. His novel, The Echo Maker, is part mystery, part science, about a 27-year-old man who falls into a coma after a car crash and wakes up with a rare brain disorder. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.